see you all this morning. Have you joined us for what looks to be an exciting and really intellectually robust day. My name is Benjamin Hopkins. I'm the director of the Seeger Center for Asian Studies here at the Elliott School. For those of you that don't know, the Seeger Center is the university center for research and teaching on Asia. In addition to being the director of the Seeger Center, I'm also the co-director of the East Asia National Resource Center, which is a Title VI funded center, which actually we just won last year, largely based off the strength of our robust East Asia program, which has for long been supported by our friends at TECRO. And it's with that in mind today that we're looking to our first of a number of conferences this year, today's being on cross-strait relations under stress. We have an absolutely fantastic lineup for you today. If you have not already grabbed a program, which have all the speaker bios as well as the events, they're available over there. In addition to advertising what is about to begin for today, I'd also like to bring your attention that on December 11th, we will be holding our next Taiwan Focus Conference, which is going to be a preview of the upcoming elections for Taiwan. So we're going to have a really interesting series. We're going to have both a discussion before the elections and then a follow-up discussion after the new year once the elections take place. So for those of you that have been following, it's a very interesting political landscape these days in Taiwan, and I think we'll have a very interesting conversation for that roundtable. But let's get back to the order of the day, and I think it goes without saying that it's an interesting time for cross-strait relations. As I've already indicated, we have a fantastic lineup of panelists, academics, and policy wonks to share their opinions and insights today. And with that, I would like to introduce the Honorable Christine Shui, who is the Deputy Representative of the Taipei Economic and Cultural Representative Office here in Washington, D.C. It's a great pleasure to have you here, and please, why don't you come up and welcome us all.
Professor Hopkins, distinguished panelists, ladies and gentlemen, good morning. It is my great pleasure and honor to be with you this morning. I'd like to first thank Seeger Center once again for putting together an inspiring and stimulating event focusing on China's pressure campaign and its implication for Taiwan and beyond. As many of you know, since the democratization movement of the 1980s, Taiwan has already gone through three rounds of transition power by direct elections. Next January, we are going to have another presidential election. Even with unavoidable outside intervention, I believe it will once again attest to the value of democracy, which people of Taiwan cherished dearly, regardless of their political affiliation. Taiwan's robust democracy is not just a success story. It is a constant reminder to the world that democracy can thrive in Chinese culture. More importantly, given China's growing soft power, Taiwan has also become the first line of defense for democratic values in the Indo-Pacific region. Even though our government, under the leadership of President Tsai Ing-wen, has tried our best to maintain the status quo across the Taiwan Strait, China's diplomatic offensives and military coercion toward Taiwan have just intensified day by day, posing a serious challenge to regional peace and stability. Not only did China malignantly crush Taiwan's international space whenever possible, they also lured away seven of our diplomatic allies in the past 4 years. In Xi Jinping's January 2nd speech, he further tried to impose one country, two systems model for Taiwan, even after the model has been proved a failure in Hong Kong, and once again threatened to use force as an option for unification with Taiwan. In the face of all this increasing pressure on our freedom and democracy, President Tsai, in her National Day address this year, calling our people to stay united, resilient, to defend our hard-won democracy. She also reaffirmed that Taiwan must fulfill its responsibility to the international community. But Taiwan will not act provocatively or rashly. Rather, we will work with like-minded countries to ensure that the peaceful and stable cross-strait status quo is not unilaterally altered. Therefore, people in Taiwan are greatly encouraged by Vice President Pence's address at Wuzhou Business Center event last week, which indicates the United States stood by Taiwan in defense of her hard-won democracy. And also his reiteration that America will always believe that Taiwan's embrace of democracy shows a better path for all the Chinese people. So, even the road ahead of us may not be smooth. We know we are not alone fighting for the good cause. With that in mind, I think you will agree with me that today's discussion of the cross-strait relations are very timely and will have implication for more than the parties on both sides of Taiwan Strait. Thank you again for having me. I look forward to learning from the wisdom and the thoughts of our distinguished panelists, and also wish today's event a great success. Thank you.
That first panel, could you join me? Thank you very much. Welcome to all of you again. It's wonderful to see such a big turnout. And I also want to thank Minister Shui for setting the stage now for this panel so wonderfully that her remarks, I think, are a good indication of why we need to have this sort of a conference at this particular time. So with me today, we're going to go right in with, I'm not going to go too much into the introduction of the panelists. None of them probably need an introduction to this audience, but they all deserve one, so I'll say a little bit of something. And let me just start by saying that some of them here, two actually have come in this morning, so I was holding my breath until they all arrived on time. And let me start with the person who will begin us off, looking at Chinese unilateralism and militarization to set a sort of looking at the defense and security and military landscape that Taiwan faces. June Dreyer is a professor of political science at the University of Miami. She has made a heroic effort to get here from Miami this morning. And she is turning right around and going back because she managed to squeeze this in between two very important personal commitments that she's got. She's also the president of the American Association for Chinese Studies, which I just found out that wasn't even on her long list of accomplishments. She has worked at the Library of Congress. She's been a advisor to the Chief of Naval Operations. And her most recent book, the 10th edition of a book that came out in 2018 called China's Political System, Modernization and Tradition. She has also, in 2017, she received the University of Miami's award as a distinguished research professor, which I think speaks volumes for her continuing contributions. She also has a PhD from Harvard. Turning to the next panelist on my left is Michael Maza, who is a visiting fellow from at the American Enterprise Institute, and he came in from New York. Right on time, so thank you, Mike. He analyzes U.S. defense policy in the Asia-Pacific region, Chinese military modernization, and he's also a non-resident fellow at the Global Taiwan Institute, and he has published widely in very well-known journals such as Foreign Affairs and Wall Street and so forth. He was also recognized as a foreign policy initiative future leader a few years ago, so keep your eye on him. And then finally, happy to introduce Bob Sutter, who came all the way from Virginia. He is my colleague at GW. He has been here since 2011. He has taught around the DMV in Georgetown, Johns Hopkins, University of Virginia. He has published 21 books and hundreds of articles, and he has been in the past, worked also at the Library of, not the Library of Congress, Congressional Research Service, and has been a National Intelligence Officer, and has a PhD from Harvard as well. Let me just say that I think they are, you know, an expert group for the topics today, and I'm going to start with June and just go down the line, and they'll speak for about 15 minutes or so, and then we'll open it up for Q&A. So thank you very much. June.
No academic can speak for only 15.
I said 15 knowing you'll take 20, but go ahead.
Anyway, Deepa has already told you my topic, and I think nobody who saw the photos of China's 70th birthday parade could doubt that there has been significant militarization in China. Now, I don't want to bore you with a long list of weapons, but among the weapons that made their debut was the Dongfeng 41, first time seen in public. And this is said to have a 9,400-mile radius, which means it could hit any place in the United States, which brought a lot of people up short. And then in the same parade was the DF-17, and this is a nuclear-capable ballistic missile that is specifically designed to carry a hypersonic glide vehicle, which is very, very scary indeed. And then, according to the Stockholm Institute of Peace Research, China has the second largest military budget in the world, United States being first. And in the 215 birthday day parade, there were the so-called Guam killer, the DF-26, and the DF-21, which is nicknamed the carrier killer. And you know whose carriers they have in mind. And you also know who has a submarine based on Guam. So that's concerning. And a Singaporean analyst, Colin Coe, revealed a couple of weeks ago on the basis of some photos from CSIS's think tank on this, what he called the start of a factory for aircraft carriers and surface ships in the Yangtze River estuary. So on the basis of that, the IISS in London, and you've noticed I'm trying to pick places here from different parts of the world, Stockholm and London and Singapore, suggested that the Chinese naval capability has entered a new phase. So point made, militarization. I was out at what was then PACOM in early, PACOM, in early 2011, and I said, is it true, you folks, what I've been hearing, the Chinese military is becoming a lot more assertive in various international fora? And the answer I got from a two-star admiral was, you better believe it. And he contrasted that with the previously much more diffident, quiet responses that you would get in the past. And thank you, Bob. And I mention this on purpose because 2010 appears to me to be a real watershed year. And the reason that's important is that people keep saying, well, this is Xi Jinping. And I would argue that it isn't Xi Jinping. I mean, it is, but it started under Hu Jintao, who is sometimes portrayed as, well, this kind of colorless guy. I know an eminent professor in a university in Shanghai, a Chinese, who sneered Hu Jintao. This is a place where good ideas go to die. And obviously, this one didn't die. And that fits in with a much more generally belligerent tone elsewhere. The ARF meeting in Hanoi, July 2010, where the Chinese foreign minister stomped out
after Hillary Clinton suggested that the South China Sea issues be settled amicably, not really a provocative statement from her point of view, and also where he looked the Singaporean foreign minister straight in the eye and said, you have to understand that some countries are big countries and some countries are small countries. And Singapore, of course, is a small country. And he essentially said, suck it up and get used to it. Only slightly more politely. So that was also about the time the Chinese were saying, or not quite saying, if you parse the grammar, that the South China Sea, that nine-dash line, was a core interest. And again, if you parse the grammar, they haven't quite said it, but they sure seem to be implying it. So 2010, another what do you call a piece of evidence for my theory here that it's 2010, is the collision between the Chinese fishing boat and the two Japanese Coast Guard vessels, after which the Chinese said, okay, we're now going to start patrolling this area, and they did. So again, it wasn't 2012, no matter what you've read, it was 2010. Now, there has been a move, counter-move. Ballet would be the wrong word for something so lethal, but 2010 was also the year that DOD announced, it was around before, but it was the 2010 was when DOD announced the air-sea battle strategy. And this is the anti-access area denial strategy, known as paralyze first and analyze later, annihilate later. And it was pretty obvious that that was China that we're talking about. So that's the United States counter move. And then shortly thereafter came Hillary Clinton's articulation of the pivot to Asia, which is then echoed by Barack Obama in his address to the Australian Parliament. And the Chinese say, okay, provocation, we need to make a counter move. And then you get the militarization of the islands. And we respond. We put Marines on a rotating basis in Darwin. And they counter by leasing the port of Darwin for 99 years. And you see what I mean by move, counter move here. And the trouble is we don't do very much to back up our presence. We announce a pivot, but we don't do a heck of a lot about it. And So this is building up, in other words, before Xi Jinping assumed power in 2012 and before Donald Trump was elected in 2016. So neither one of them deserves the blame or the praise for starting this, depending on your point of view. Now, this is followed by a number of unpleasant incidents between U.S. ships and planes, and being shadowed and harassed by Chinese ships and planes, with the usual thing in the press, is this mean going to war? And since this is the U.S. press, is this worth going to war about? Which is taken by the Chinese side, correctly, I think, as a sign that we would have cold feet about doing so. And there's a lot of concern, I know this, from people among what was then PAYCOM and now is Indo-PAYCOM, that the political authorities were not telling the American people what was really going on. And a confirmation of that, a couple of weeks ago, a DIA counterintelligence analyst was arrested and charged with leaking classified information on missiles to two journalists. In other words, he was not selling things to the Chinese. He was leaking the classified information on the Chinese missiles to journalists in the United States. Okay? And the missiles in this case, and again, I have this, if anybody's interested, I can tell you what they were, but they are able to, they're long-range surface-to-air missiles that can target aircraft, drones, and cruise missiles within 160 nautical miles on three of the reefs that the Chinese have fortified. And according to CSIS's Greg Poling, they They've also appeared in satellite images of Woody Island, which is the center of China's presence in the South China Sea. And he says from there you're going to see them migrate to other ones in other of these fortified islands. So that's creeping aggression in the South China Sea. And I noticed that Harry Harris, who was then head of PACOM, testifying to the House Armed Services Committee, I believe it was, said, ladies and gentlemen, China's intent is crystal clear. We ignore it at our peril. And Harris's successor said something very similar. So that's the South China Sea. As I mentioned before, the East China Sea appears to be more one, less confrontation, less overtly confrontational, but kind of eating slowly away at Japan's claimed sovereignty in the East China Sea. And Chinese fishermen have avoided the waters around the Senkaku Islands for about 10 years ago, again, predating Xi Jinping. And the Japanese have fortified, not the Senkakus, but the islands in the area. This has really been like pulling teeth without anesthetic, because the people on the islands don't want a military presence there. This is a Japanese military presence. And as we all know, Japan doesn't have a military. It has a self-defense force, but same difference. Okay, what about joint exercises with the United States? These happen periodically, and it somewhat amuses me to see that these are all islands. The exercises are all geared at retaking the islands. Notice, not defending the islands, but retaking the islands. And there is method behind this, because the United States has not pledged to defend those islands against creeping osmosis. It's pledged to defend them against invasion. And what's happening is not an invasion, it's osmosis. So that again is a little bit scary. And I hear all these scenarios, what if China invaded, blah, blah, blah. And I'm saying, what? This assumes a lack of acumen on the Chinese, which we shouldn't assume. They're very smart. Why would they bother invading when the salami tactics are working so well? And possibly you guys will take this up further, because it seems to me that's their strategy with regard to Taiwan as well. Scary weapons, but that's not their ultimate strategy. Now, it's easy to say that United States could have done more, but think about it. First of all, acting unilaterally is going to elicit a chorus of unilateralism and warmongering and heaven knows what. And second, the United States has never recognized anybody's sovereignty over those contested islands, okay? So perhaps all that we can do is in what Ash Carter suggested, 4 years ago now, approximately 2016, to insist on flying and sailing wherever international law allows, and not allow ourselves to be bullied by periodic confrontations with the Chinese Navy ships and airplanes. Okay, so that's number one. Option number two is join with allies. And I was born and brought up in Brooklyn, and I know exactly what my fellow Brooklynites would say, which is something like, oy vey. And we have tried. The Quad, which was actually proposed by a Japanese prime minister, with India and Australia and Japan, there's a wonderful article a couple months ago by Kevin Rudd, the former Prime Minister of Australia, in which he goes into great detail about the problems of the Quad, And basically, these can be summarized because Deepa's going to cut me off in about 2 minutes. Basically, this can be summarized very quickly in that all of these countries are democracies. That was a whole idea, an alliance of democracies.